It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll dive into the world of extra virgin olive oil on Food Friday.
First, Wisconsin is in the midst of a battle against heroin addiction and overdoses around the state. It's something we've been following here on Central Time.
Earlier this year, Governor Walker signed into law a set of bills aimed at stemming addiction and making it easier for emergency responders to respond to overdoses.
Today, the State Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse released a set of recommendations focused on treatment and prevention of heroin use. They come following a heroin symposium earlier this week in Milwaukee.
Here with us to talk about these new recommendations from a medical perspective is Dr. Sarah Andrizzi. She works with Advanced Pain Management and practices at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She spoke earlier this week at that heroin summit in Milwaukee. Dr. Andrizzi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, as we mentioned, we've got a parcel of new legislation out there. Still more to do, you think, when it comes to heroin addiction in Wisconsin?
Certainly, yes. And, you know, we in the medical community, these recommendations are brand new. So they just came out earlier today. Mm-hmm. So we're in the midst, we in the medical community are in the midst of kind of going through, sifting through this 80-page document regarding these recommendations. And we're all very interested in seeing how we can all kind of collaboratively work together, state and local government, law enforcement, community workers, education, and medical professionals can work together to reduce heroin and other prescription opioid overdose deaths.
What are a couple of the next steps you'd like to see Wisconsin take and that coalition of different partners you mentioned take when it comes to preventing heroin addiction in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Well, and prevention is one of the key. There were five pillars of the recommendations that were put forth today, and prevention is one of the, and actually the first kind of key pillar. And so in that category, they are looking to promote increased community awareness about substance abuse and also to try and kind of reduce the stigma associated with substance abuse and associated with, obtaining help for substance abuse issues. They're also looking to increase funding for substance abuse coalitions, providing alternative opportunities for at-risk youth to provide other options for them as far as things to help prevent heroin or specifically, but any drug use initially, and then also getting them access to substance abuse treatment if that is an issue down the line. And then the other big point under the prevention category, they are looking to recruit employers, government agencies, nonprofits to really get involved in prevention and intervention activities.
That's the prevention pillar. What are some of the other key points in today's recommendations?
Correct. The other four pillars from the recommendation include harm reduction, and under that category include things like syringe exchange programs, HIV, hepatitis C testing programs for at-risk drug users, increasing funding for naloxone, which is branded under the brand name of Narcan, which is the anti-heroin overdose drug. Increasing funding for that and training for that so that we can get that into the hands of other members of the community, whether that be first responders, police officers, EMTs, et cetera. Along with that, they're looking to provide prescriptions for Narcan along with opioid prescriptions. That is one of their recommendations. The third pillar that went along with these recommendations was the law enforcement pillar. Basically, they are recommending that communities develop a system wherein community members can turn over illegal drugs or legal prescription drugs that they maybe have obtained illegally or are no longer using and be able to properly dispose of those medications without significant repercussions, legal repercussions.
So a no questions asked sort of way to get rid of drugs that came into your possession one way or another.
Exactly correct. Mm-hmm.
And then that leaves two more pillars.
Correct. The fourth pillar is the treatment recommendations. The main recommendations in this pillar include increasing access to inpatient detoxification programs and inpatient and then outpatient community support programs. And as a member of the medical community who deals with a lot of opioid abuse in particular, that is an area of interest, I believe, particularly for the medical community. It's an area of difficulty for us in really directing patients towards these resources. And then the fifth pillar is workplace recommendations. So encouraging every workplace to have a clear workplace anti-drug policy, encouraging employers to have in place education and prevention resources for their employees, training for supervisors as to how they can identify drug use amongst their employees, how they can report that, and then consistent drug testing programs for workplace environments.
I want to dig deeper into one theme that came up a couple times there, and a story we've heard again and again where people start on prescription opioids,
yes,
either that were prescribed to them for a valid medical reason or that they've gotten from a relative or bought from someone, and then ultimately turning into a heroin addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need to be prescribing these medications less in the first place? How do you balance pain management versus risk of addiction?
It's a good question, and it's a tricky question to adequately address. And we know a couple of things. Number one, we know that since 1999, so for the past 13 years that we have this data, opioid-related, and this is prescription, opioid-related deaths have significantly increased every year. And those parallel the increase in opioid prescriptions that have been given in the U.S. We also know that between 1992 and the mid-2000s, the amount of opioid prescriptions that were given in the United States increased by about 150%. But at that same time, the number of teenagers who are new illicit prescription drug users increased by over 500%. So we know that, going along with this increase in opioid prescription is an increase in illicit or using these medications not as prescribed, especially amongst teenagers. And at that same time, we have seen a significant increase in heroin overdose and heroin use. From 2009 to 2013 in Wisconsin, the number of heroin overdose deaths increased by 170%. So, it's a significant increase in a short period of time. And we know that prescription opioids and illegal drugs such as heroin, they work on the same mechanisms in the brain. Basically, in 1895, Bayer Drug Group introduced a new pain medication which was they claimed would be a non-addictive replacement for morphine. They called it diacetylmorphine, and they branded it under the name of heroin. So we know that heroin and opioid prescriptions, they're all related. And when we see the risk or the increase in prescription medications and the risk of prescription opioid-related deaths increase, we know that there is a correlation with the increase in heroin deaths also.
Well, as we wrap up now, we've got these recommendations. You've got these recommendations out today. Where do they go? Who picks them up and runs with them?
So, again, it's going to be kind of a collaborative effort between law enforcement, community groups, employers, healthcare, the medical community, and then state and local governments. And so it really is. And they've outlined, ways that all of these groups can kind of work together. And it is going to be, a multi-prong approach to trying to reduce these deaths.
Dr. Andrizzi, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Dr. Sarah Andrizzi. She works in advanced pain management and practices at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She spoke earlier this week at a heroin symposium in Milwaukee, and today the State Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse released a set of recommendations focused on treatment and prevention of heroin use.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Food Friday. Today we're diving into the world of olive oil.
With plenty of options and varieties of olive oil to choose from, it can be hard to know what to pick out at the grocery store. And then once we finally pick an olive oil, sometimes we just use it as a salad dressing or a bread dip. But our next guest says there's much more we can be doing with olive oil, and she's got the recipes to prove it.
Mary Plattis joins us now. She's a chef and a food blogger and the co-author of the book Cooking Techniques and Recipes with Olive Oil. Mary, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Well, I gather from your book, you are a huge fan of olive oil. What makes it so special?
Well, I am. Being Greek, it runs through our veins, so that's number one. But most importantly, it is a cornerstone of the Mediterranean diet that we're all talking about. It's a heart-healthy oil, and it's the only oil you should be using in your cooking.
So it's hard to know what to pick up because there's a million bottles of olive oil these days at the grocery store, and you want the good stuff. You don't want stuff that's been filtered down usually or mixed with other things. How do we know that we're picking out a good bottle?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And as the years go by, I'm noticing that the section at the grocery store is getting smaller and smaller, which is good for the consumer. But once you pick out an extra virgin olive oil, not a virgin or a pure, it must say extra virgin olive oil, there's several things you can look for. And one of them is the organic seal. That guarantees a first cold-pressed olive oil. So look for seals like the California Olive Oil Commission. Or if you're getting a European olive oil, look for the IOOC seal. But if none of those are on there, what you can do is turn your bottle around, and if it says extra virgin olive oil as the only ingredient, then you've got a great bottle. Because if it says refined oil, you must put it down. That means it's mixed in with, you know, fake oil or bad oils, bad saturated oils. So overall, and one more thing, make sure it has a harvest date, not a best buy date. That's sort of a supermarket thing, you know, they add on those bottles, but it must have a harvest date, which tells you it was produced in 2014.
So you can't go by color either, it sounds like. That's not part of the criteria.
Yeah, no, color has absolutely, you know, olive oil comes in various colors according to when it has been picked and processed. So that's no indication, unfortunately.
So
when you do select an olive oil, make sure it's in a dark bottle and make sure that you buy a small bottle, not those big tin cans, because, you know, most consumers can't use up that much olive oil within a year.
So you say we should be cooking with olive oil, doing just about everything in it. And there are probably two responses out there. Some people are saying, of course, I cook with olive oil all the time. And some people are saying, no, wait, I heard you're not supposed to heat olive oil up too much. Smoke points, bad things happen, that sort of thing. Can we cook pretty much any temperature, anything with olive oil?
You know, absolutely. Those are all misconceptions. Olive oil smokes at, and I think people are getting confused with the smoking point and the actual heating point. A good olive oil can go all the way up to between 365 and 400. So most people don't fry over that amount, you know, that temperature. And if they do, they have to actually fry for over like 90 minutes before the olive oil begins to lose its nutrients. And most people don't fry for 90 minutes. So that's what the studies are showing. So, yes, you can cook with it. In Europe, that's all they use. And Americans are starting to use olive oil now that they hear that it's a healthier choice.
So what does olive oil do to the flavor of the food we're eating? I know it varies in flavor. It can be kind of sharper and peppier, more peppery. Mm-hmm. It can be sort of fruity tasting. But how does it sort of change the chemistry of the food we're eating?
Well, it doesn't change the chemistry as much as it enhances the flavor. So let's say you use a first press harvest, which is early in the fall. That's a pungent, very strong olive oil. And those olive oils can be used for braising, a roast, or it could be used for if you want a pungent flavor when cooking something like roasting a chicken. And then you can use the mid-season, which is January and February. That's the second round of milling the olives, and it has a slight milder taste. So you can use that for your vegetables, and most people don't know that there are three different types of oils. And later in the season, in the spring, you'll get a very mild, and that's what most consumers love. So if you like that mild, buttery flavor, you can use it. You can actually use it in your ice cream and baking goods.
Well, let's follow up with that baking concept. You sent us a recipe. We've got it up on the Central Time Facebook page. It is dark chocolate olive oil cake with strawberries. You had me a dark chocolate cake and strawberries, but what does the olive oil do for a chocolate cake recipe?
Well, for any baking, what we're doing is we're substituting butter. And in most European recipes, they use olive oil in substitution for butter. So we're taking the fat out, the saturated fat of the butter out, and we're adding the olive oil. And in something like this where you're using a dark chocolate, you can use just about any olive oil. And it just gives it a nice moist. It keeps the baked goods moist and rich in flavor.
Well, we're in Wisconsin. Are you saying something is better than dairy in a cake?
No, we all love our cheeses, and we all love our butters. We're just giving you options so that you can use up that great bottle of olive oil that was given to you, you know, perhaps for a birthday or a gift.
Can you walk us through that recipe a little bit? It was beautiful. We all stopped and ogled it when we got to that page.
Well, you know, it's a perfect summer recipe, because who doesn't like chocolate, right? And strawberries are coming into season.
Right.
And basically, it's a throw-together recipe. You add your flour and cocoa powder, all the dry ingredients together, and then you mix your sugar. And it also has Greek yogurt, by the way, which is also a great choice instead of sour cream or, you know, again, butter. And then you add the olive oil, and you combine those to three or four ingredients. And in just small batches, you mix the flour together with the dry ingredients with the wet ingredients, and add your chocolate chips. That's it. And you just arrange your strawberries on top, stick it in the oven for 40-45 minutes, and when it comes out, you gently can add some powdered sugar. Yum. Or how about a scoop of vanilla ice cream?
Wow.
Well, it's grilling season, turning away from desserts for a moment. Do you have tips on marinating using olive oil, or a suggested recipe?
We do. In fact, marinating is what most people use when they're making a homemade marinade. We're trying to get away from the processed bottles and also the dry ingredients that you add that you're not quite sure is in those dry powders. So we have several recipes for chicken kebabs, and we also marinate pork tenderloin and salmon and New York strip steak, and any of those can be thrown on the barbecue.
And that's the beauty of it, huh? You can just, it's already been marinating in the olive oil, so you don't have to grease the grill. Can you just stick it on the grill?
That's right. And what's really nice is it keeps the moisture in the meat as well when you marinate with olive oil. So, and it also protects your meat or your chicken while it's on the grill. So it has several different benefits for that grilling season.
And here's was a new one to me in your cookbook, drinks with olive oil. That I don't think of olive oil as a cocktail mixer.
Well, it was a long night. No, my partner and I were mixing up a little drink one evening, and we had a little bit of vodka and some ouzo, and we had decided to add watermelon and a little bit of olive oil on top, and it makes a great shot.
What does it do to it? Does it just help it go down nice and smooth?
Yeah, you know, it helps the vodka with its flavor. In fact, you know how strong it can be sometimes? So in a little shot glass. So when we added the oil coats your mouth before the vodka hits it. So it just goes down smoother.
Sounds like
a couple more.
Like hot, yeah, right. Hot buttered rum, but not hot and no rum and no butter. Well, how about we've got our good olive oil. How about some storage tips? How do we keep it good for as long as it lasts?
Well, that's a very good question, and many people do put their olive oil next to their oven because that's, you know, that's just simple
it's
and
handy.
Easy. But basically, it needs to be away from the heat in your pantry as well as away from light, because light oxidizes the olive oil, and that's why they put it in the dark bottle. And let's say you do buy a great bottle of olive oil at a farm or a store, and it's in a clear bottle. We suggest that you pour it out into an old wine bottle or a darker container and place it in your pantry.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Mary, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's Mary Plattis. She's a chef and a food blogger. We've been talking about the book she co-authored. It's called Cooking Techniques and Recipes with Olive Oil.
And don't forget, we've got that recipe for that dark chocolate strawberry cake with olive oil and Greek yogurt up on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're going to make that this weekend, bringing it on
Did
Monday?
Did you read my mind?
Yeah.
Yes, I am going to make it this
you really
weekend.
Are? Oh,
I
awesome.
Think I am.
Maybe Wait, I'll you didn't say in. You're going to bring it in. Yeah.
No, I didn't say that.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
There's a lot of talk about our aging population in Wisconsin and the nation as a whole. A lot of times the focus is on the negatives: health costs, difficulties faced by caregivers, trouble finding appropriate residential facilities.
Our next guests, though, say there are a lot of good things going on in our state when it comes to health and aging, and they're here to share some of the growing number of programs aimed at helping people live healthier and happier lives as they age.
Our guests are both with the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging. Dr. Jane Mahoney is the group's executive director and a professor of geriatric medicine at UW-Madison. Dr. Mahoney, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Betsy Abramson is deputy director of the Institute. Betsy, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Rob.
Well, Betsy, I think it can be easy to think that aging and bad health are just hand in hand. It's natural. And I imagine you're trying to turn that idea around. What's your goal at the Institute on healthy aging?
Our goal is to show people that by pursuing research, evidence-based programs, that they can actually continue to lead very healthy, happy lives long, long, long past that silly number of 60 or 65.
And Jane, it sounded like a key word there, evidence-based. What kind of interventions are we looking for? What kind of proof do we need that they're worth focusing on?
So evidence-based really means that we have done enough research to establish that it really works. And the gold standard is what we call a randomized controlled trial. So we prove it works by comparing it to another type of intervention, or what we often say is usual care. And people in the study, the research study, are randomized by chance, flip of a coin, to either receive the intervention or to receive something else. And if we can show it works in comparison with something else, we know it's truly going to work and ready to get it out there.
And before we get into the particular health interventions, Betsy, what happens next? We've got the research. We know this thing works. Maybe it's cost effective. What's the next step to get it out there to help people?
Well, Rob, the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging is really based on the concept of the Wisconsin idea. Research that's been pursued and proven at the University of Wisconsin belongs to the people of Wisconsin. So it's my job and the partners that we work with here in Wisconsin to get it out to folks. We approach healthcare providers, insurance companies, especially the folks in our aging network, our aging and disability resource centers and county aging units who are partners, public health agencies, and say, look what we've got. This can reduce falls by 31%. This can reduce hospitalizations, ED, emergency department visits. And we work with them to train them to deliver the programs in the same exact way that they were proven over at the university side, so we can get the same good outcomes for folks.
And would this also go to like a senior community center or a senior residential home?
Absolutely. Those are some of our very best partners. We go where folks go. We do them in church basements. We do them in healthcare clinics, senior centers, nutrition sites, community centers.
And Jane, Betsy just mentioned falling a moment ago, and I want to look at that as a concrete example. The falling is one of those things that sounds like a little thing. I gather it makes a huge difference. I know you do research on it. How big a problem, first of all, is falling for seniors?
Well, about one-third of older adults fall each year. And if you've fallen once, you have a 50% chance of falling again. And for people who fall, they have about a 50% chance of having some injury that's going to impact their day-to-day life, whether it's for a few days or weeks. So it's a serious problem. And what we know from the medical care side of things is we can't do it all within the clinic. There has to be another part of falls prevention that happens in the community.
And you know, Rob, that as Dr. Mahoney mentioned, such a serious problem. 40% of everyone who goes into a nursing home, which is most older people's greatest fear, had a fall 30 days prior. And falls-related injuries now are the leading cause of injury-related deaths in Wisconsin. More than car crashes, more than anything else, are the injuries from falls of all ages, and especially, of course, older adults.
And on top of that, I imagine it's a big downturn in quality of life.
Absolutely. For most people who enter that nursing home after a fall, they don't always come out, and often that's the beginning of the end, and not happy about it. But the good news is that falls can be prevented.
And I was going to say, we've heard that you've laid down the bad news pretty well there.
Yeah.
Research side, Dr. Mahoney, what are some of the proven things that help keep people from falling in the first place?
Well, one of the most important that we've learned about is balance and strength exercise in combination. And the balance exercise is really things that people learn to do standing up that practices their balance. And the more you practice, the better you get. So any types of things we can do in the community setting, classes, it could be Tai Chi, it could be classes that we offer from Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging, and also physical therapy, all help improve your balance. Another area that we know is really important is medications. And one of the things that I like to say to explain to my patients that I see in the falls clinic is, if your pill bottle says caution with driving, you should probably think that it's also going to say caution, or should say caution with walking, because those same kind of medications that are mildly sedating can increase falls risk. So it's so important that older adults talk to their physician, get their medications checked, see if they can decrease any medication to decrease their risk of falls.
And Betsy, can you tell us about some of the things that are in practice right now in the state when it comes to some of the things she was just mentioning?
Well, in addition to us doing general public awareness campaigns, probably our seminal program is a 7-week community-based workshop called Stepping On. It's 7 weeks, 2 hours a week. It was actually developed in Australia, and then Dr. Mahoney brought it here to Wisconsin, retested it, and found that the way she did it here in Wisconsin was even a greater reduction in falls. And it has the four components, two of which Dr. Mahoney just mentioned, the strength and leading people in learning how to do strength and balance exercises, the medication review. We actually bring a pharmacist in to go over medications with people to see who's on what we call FRIDS, falls risk-inducing drugs. They also learn about the importance of vision. You know, those bifocals that are great for reading are also what you look down for when you're going down a step and can cause falls. And then the fourth is a home modification. And that means more than just the throw rugs. But most importantly, all these workshops are taught with the principles of adult learning and teach self-efficacy. The idea of two components, that you get to pick the choices you want to make, which rugs you want to move, what lights you want to add on, how you want to change things up. And then secondly, you learn the skills to believe that you have the confidence to make them happen.
Let's follow up on those points, Dr. Mahoney. The self-efficacy, the behavior alteration. Doctors and nurses can't follow us all home and make sure we're doing the right things. Is that a common theme in a lot of the interventions you look at?
Absolutely. All of the interventions from the Wisconsin Institute of Healthy Aging have a very big component of self-efficacy. And because we know that, for example, chronic diseases, one of the most important things you can do to improve your quality of life and decrease your healthcare costs is actually learn how to manage it yourself. And that takes self-efficacy, building your own belief that you can do it, and then learning how to do it. So throughout all these healthcare programs, self-management programs, they're founded on this very strong belief, and we know it works, that if we teach people how to take care of themselves, they'll get healthier.
I think one of the things that we didn't mention related to kind of the opposite of self-efficacy really is being terrified of doing anything. And one of the other consequences of falls, in addition to the injuries and the nursing home admissions and the costs, is a feeling that, oh my gosh, if I move again, I'll fall again. And people become increasingly isolated. Once they realize, wait a minute, I have the skills and tools to learn how to prevent falls myself, that I have increased my strength and balance, I've made the changes in my home, I've had my medications reviewed. I know I have the right vision prescriptions. They build, as a matter of fact, stepping on is called reducing falls and building confidence. And folks then are not nearly as isolated, which, as I'm sure you know, can be have terrible health consequences as well.
A word I don't know if we've said out loud here, but it just keeps popping in my head as you talk, is empowerment. And it sounds like empowering the seniors in their healthcare lifestyles, I guess, is a key to all of this.
Absolutely. And I think this is why it's so important that in addition to having clinical care that you get from your doctor and your providers, we also have this other side of how we empower ourselves as we're living in the community, working with other older adults and going through programs like falls prevention.
We're talking to Dr. Jane Mahoney and Betsy Abramson. They're with the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging. They're telling us what's going on in the state when it comes to prevention and healthy living for older Wisconsinites. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation about health and aging in Wisconsin, looking at preventive health care, exercise, and more. Our guests are Dr. Jane Mahoney and Betsy Abramson with the Wisconsin Institute on Healthy Aging.
And you can join the program at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, or experiences. If you're a senior in Wisconsin, have you been through some kind of training on falls prevention? Do you do an exercise program? Have you done a community program helping you deal with diabetes or another chronic condition? Maybe not you, maybe your parents are going through this. Or if you're on the other side of things, if you work in a senior care center or in healthcare, love to hear from you as well. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's get into chronic conditions a little bit. What kind of research is out there when it comes to helping people deal with something like a very common condition, diabetes, Dr. Mahoney?
So diabetes is so common, and particularly in Wisconsin, and it's associated, obviously, with obesity. So it's something that we need to be really thinking about with our state. What we've learned is that self-management programs, the same way work for diabetes, they help people improve their blood sugar control and feel like they can take more control over their lives and over their condition.
And when somebody goes through a program like this, Betsy, what kind of things do you hear from people, their before and after pictures before they go through this kind of training?
It's amazing. Folks with a range of chronic conditions, and by the way, 80% of older adults in Wisconsin have one chronic condition and 50% have two or more, like diabetes, arthritis, heart conditions, kidney problems, lung problems. And folks had thought, well, there's nothing I can do about it. It's just the thing that I have. And the doctor will fix it. And then when they think about it, they realize, gee, I see the doctor maybe four times a year, but all 365, I'm dealing with the diabetes or the arthritis. And they thought they just had to accept the fatigue, the pain, the cutting back on activities, and they discover that through the self-efficacy skills that they learn in these programs, that they can create small, achievable goals that almost always head towards improving their nutrition, increasing their exercise, increasing their social activity, that ends up helping them significantly better manage their chronic conditions.
And Dr. Mahoney, you are a physician, and I assume you talk to other physicians. Do they sometimes have that sense of inevitability? I'm going to see this person with a chronic condition a couple few times a year. I give them the advice. I cross my fingers and hope that they can do something with it. What do they say about programs like this?
I think doctors, and this is something that we need to make that connection more and more, physicians know that what they do in the clinic is only half of the story. Mm-hmm. But they don't know how, and they have very busy schedules. They don't know how to really help older adults get the tools to better manage their conditions. So the more that we help physicians know what's out there in the community in terms of these classes, the better they're going to do.
And I think doctors who have had experience referring their patients to and recommending their patients to this program are astonished to see the results and are thrilled that they think, funny, I told them to quit smoking or cut back on the red meat or do more exercise or lose 10 pounds for years. But it's only after they take this workshop when they decide through the kind of accountability and peer support that happens in this group that they realize, wow, I'm not the only person. I don't have to just do the woe is me thing. I can actually take steps and, as you said, Rob, empower myself and make these changes based on the decisions I want to do because I want to take control of the arthritis or diabetes instead of it controlling me.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Anne on the line in Maple. Anne, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to share with us?
Well, I wanted to share that I have been participating for probably 20 years with a show in the morning. I'm up in the Duluth area, not too far from Duluth, but in Wisconsin, and so I get Minnesota Public Television, and there's a show called Body Electric by Margaret Richard, who does all the muscle groups throughout a period of days and repeats these same exercises within a half an hour with a warm-up, a cool-down, at the end. And all of it is pertaining basically to strengthening the muscles because, as she always says, the pull on the bone strengthens the muscle and strengthens the bone.
And that's targeted towards seniors, this show, Anne?
It tends to be, yes.
Okay.
I mean, I've been doing it for 20 years, and I'm 64, so I just feel a lot stronger. And balance, I agree about the balance thing. That's a really important thing. And she does, you know, everything from the shoulders to the quadriceps to the calves, not all in one show, but she rotates the repeated shows.
Gotcha. And I want to get our guests in on this. Thank you so much for calling and sharing that. I don't know if that's a program you're familiar with, but does it sound like it's kind of on the right track?
I'm not actually familiar with that program, but I think a lot of the concepts are very much the same. One of the things that we stress over and over is that as you get older, you can still keep doing exercise. It's just the exercise needs to be modified for you. And you can still keep doing balance exercise. So what happens is as people get really old, they end up doing chair exercises. And chair exercises are great, but they only improve your balance for sitting in a chair. If you want to improve your balance for standing, you have to do standing exercises. So one of the things we really try to do is stress the importance of, at any age, there are ways to do standing exercises safely, and that'll help your balance.
But I really want to congratulate Anne. She found a system that works for her. So it sounds like you started it at 44, so you have developed a very healthy lifestyle and good habit that's going to take you well on into your older years, and I hope you keep championing it with your friends and family.
And Betsy, people out there teaching these outreach programs to seniors presumably are tailoring the exercises to the needs and abilities of seniors.
All of our programs were, as Dr. Mahoney mentioned, run through randomized control trials on older adults. So they were designed by researchers with partners in older adult communities for older adults. And I should point out that our Living Well with Chronic Conditions and our Healthy Living with Diabetes program and our Powerful Tools for Caregivers are for folks of any age, are stepping on the strength and balance exercises there that were developed in Australia. Is that right, Dr. Mahoney?
Mm-hmm.
The Otego exercises. Those are evidence-based for older adults only.
And one of the exciting things about stepping on, which makes it safe, is that a physical therapist comes to the first two sessions, actually helps people get started with exercises that are the right level for them. So in disseminating it around Wisconsin and the country, we've really seen that it's been very safe for older adults to do.
And as you said, they really target the exercises. Some folks start out, they can only do it clutching the table for dear life as they do the exercise, and that's fine. But you'll see over the 7 weeks, if they keep doing them at home and in the workshop, pretty soon they'll just lighten up their grip. Pretty soon they'll just hover, and then they'll go hands-free.
All right, I want to go back to our callers now. We've got Lois on the line in La Crosse. Lois, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling about my mother who lives in the Green Bay area, and I'm wondering if there's a program that I could interest her in. She hasn't been out of the house in probably a couple years, so she's missing graduations, baptism.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Lois. Yeah. Well, the good news is that Brown County has a very robust level of programs. You can call the Aging and Disability Resource Center of Brown County, or you can look on our website, and I'm sure there's going to be a link on it from WPR. That's www.withhealthyaging.org, wihealthyaging.org. You can click on Find a Program. You can sort by county. But you should definitely, your mom, that sounds like there's quite a lot going on with her if she's been in the house for a couple of years. So I would definitely call the Aging and Disability Resource Center. There's a range of wonderful services they'll have, from friendly visitors to transportation to the kinds of evidence-based health promotion programs we have, socialization programs. And let's get her back out enjoying life as she deserves to.
Lois, thanks, and good luck to you and to your mom. And are there things like this available pretty much wherever we are in the state?
As of the end of 2013, our programs, at least one, if not more of our, if not all four of our programs were operating in 62 of Wisconsin's 72 counties. Okay. And Dr. Mahoney reminds me every day, our goal is to get them in all 72 counties. So we're working on it.
Dr. Mahoney, it sounds like, you know, we think of seniors and healthcare and expensive. It sounds like a lot of these interventions aren't all that expensive. This is a cheap way to deal with big issues here.
Absolutely. You know, you get a leader trained, and for chronic disease self-management, living well with chronic conditions, our leaders get trained, but they're actually people like the people in the workshops. They have chronic conditions themselves, and they know what it's all about. Once a leader is trained, they can put on the workshop anywhere, and the cost for participants in many places is a sliding scale, but it can be around up to $25. So it's an incredibly efficient and effective way of cutting down on healthcare costs.
Our research on the program that Dr. Mahoney was just talking about shows that for every $1 invested, there's $4 saved. So I was talking to a policymaker the other day about funding the program, and they said, oh, no new money for new initiatives. I thought these programs will pay for themselves four times over. And we're just talking financial costs, not the pain and suffering of suffering from a fall or lacking confidence so that you stay in your home, as Lois just mentioned about her mother. So we're talking quality of life, bending the cost curve, saving all of us a lot of financial and physical and emotional costs.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Mahoney, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And Betsy, thank you.
Appreciate the opportunity to share our good work. Thanks.
We've been talking to Betsy Abramson. She's Deputy Director of the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging, and Dr. Jane Mahoney, the Institute's Executive Director and Professor of Geriatric Medicine at UW-Madison.